everybody, welcome to OS News Podcast, episode number 44 freaking zero, for January the 9th, 2011. We are making another podcast. We've decided to do this whenever big news strikes and there's enough interest for something to discuss. And, excuse me, there is plenty to discuss. With me today is our regular Tom Haroda.
Hello.
And volunteering your time to join us again, it's Tess Flynn.
Hello.
Hello. Right here, everybody. there's nothing to announce before we get started, I suppose.
Was there anything from well, last week? It was 2 weeks ago, I think. But anything that, like, in the comments? I didn't really read the comments.
Actually, you just completely caught me out because I didn't even think of last week's episode, or last month's episode. Where is it?
I think it's on the next somewhere. There we go. Yeah, there it is. I got it. Let me see.
Your comments. That's just quite a lot for a
podcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the stuff about.
What we do.
No, I believe it was something about HTML5 that we used it as an umbrella term. Well, we do, so we know there's a lot more to it than just.
Yeah,
that's...
it's wrong, but it's unavoidable.
Yeah. You
know, the market is going that way. Do not fight it. It's a sad and pathetic thing to do. I think I said, you know, trying to fight for naming HTML5 the right thing is like correcting everybody in use of GNU / Linux.
Yeah, but at the same time, whenever you wanted to refer to all those technologies, it would take 10 minutes before
yes.
you were done. It's completely idiotic. Let's just call it HTML5. Get over it. Next.
Don't say that to an IBMer.
Okay.
You'll get a huge log of a line of acronyms that go out the door and into the next street.
I think that was about it.
Yeah, that's about it. Okay, let's move on. The big inescapable, unavoidable topic that we're all here to discuss is Microsoft / Windows / Nvidia / ARM.
Yeah, and not just Nvidia, but a couple of other... I believe Texas Instruments and Qualcomm, right? We're also, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and Texas Instruments. Those will initially be supported by a new release of Windows. Well, basically, the next release of Windows. We don't know what it's going to be called. Well, let's just call it Windows 8, because it makes the most sense right now. They're porting it to, well, I think they already ported it 10 years ago, but they're going to release a port of Windows NT for the ARM architecture. And initially, it will be supported by NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and Texas Instruments, but it's open to everybody else to join in who's making ARM stuff. So you'll probably see, I don't know, what kind of companies make popular ARM chips, about a million, I think. And they can all get their stuff supported, and it will be in a nice, consistent package. I think it's really interesting, really fun as well. But the most important bit is something that we don't yet know, which is how they're going to handle the applications. Which are obviously coded for the Intel architecture for x86.
But not necessarily.
You have to, if it's .NET, then, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you read a lot of the articles that are the most hottest about the ARM announcement, is that they keep talking about Windows 8 having a, quote, new application in packaging or infrastructure or something. I forget what the exact words were, but it was strongly indicated that it would be XAML, and XAML leads you right to .NET.
Yeah, I believe it's called Jupyter. That's the code name.
Yeah, Jupyter.
I'm going to write about that tonight, so I saw it last night before I went to bed. There's a couple of rumors about that, indeed. You're right.
And this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because moving all of the software over to an existing architecture that they already have, that many new applications have already used. I think Office actually is written at least partially in XAML and .NET.
Yeah, it was ported to. They also, besides Windows NT on ARM, they also showed Office running on ARM, which is pretty interesting. So I don't know yet how you would use the regular Office on
quite,
ARM.
I haven't seen I can't seem to find a screenshot or picture or something of that, because this is what I was wondering about. In fact, I was discussing this with Tess before the show. My opinion is, and I hope I can be corrected on this with some screenshots or something, is that when we're talking about Windows and Office on ARM, we're talking about Windows and Office on ARM by brand only, in that Microsoft Windows and Office are Microsoft's inescapably big brands, which is the only thing they have to go on. In fact, it's their biggest, you know, it's it's their revenue at the moment.
Well, I don't have a screenshot, but what was shown, at least yes. That's what I understand from the words, but also from the people that saw it, was we're talking about Windows proper, as in Windows NT with Windows, everything that comes with it, including Office and everything that comes with it.
Yeah, but the user interface and everything would be just as it would be on like Windows 7.
Yeah, it looked exactly the same. The only difference, which is really interesting, the only difference, which only applies to nerds like me who are really into all the consistency stuff, is that on the one screenshot that they showed of the photo, basically, of Windows NT running on ARM, was that the title in the title bar.
Oh, right. Now, title,
was shifted.
Yes, I remember.
Was centered, which is bringing it in line with how it's been in Office 2007 and Office 2010. So that's the only difference that I could visually see.
Oh, that's a blooming big disappointment. I was hoping that Microsoft would use this opportunity to move away from Windows of old in the
yes,
same way.
They are doing that. They are doing that.
Well, no, I suppose it's good.
Just because it's a prototype doesn't mean that's what the final product is going to look like.
They've just ported it directly, and that the actual innovation will come later. Because
the rumors are that, which is also part of the whole Jupyter thing that we just talked about, is that there's a tile-based interface a la Windows Phone 7.
Yeah.
That's being readied as well as part of Windows 8, and you won't see that interface running on a normal PC, although obviously somebody will get it running, don't worry. But it will be part of Windows 8, basically an interface for tablets. And, with all the modularization that they've been doing in Windows NT, I think it's, entirely, acceptable for it to run on a tablet, no problem.
They're doing the right thing. They're basically doing exactly what Apple have done with the iPad. They've taken part of Mac OS X and they've made iOS. And this is what I'm hoping that Microsoft are doing with this, is that Windows on PC and Windows on tablet is to be compared in the same way that Mac OS X is on desktop computers and on tablets, and the same with the software that Office on PC I work on Mac is to what I work is on a tablet, just
yeah,
the name only.
And I also read that the engine of Microsoft Office, which is has been separated from the actual interface, and that they can run the engine with a different interface.
They've been doing that for a while because the engine is very old. The engine is 25 years old in places, and it's mostly a combination of C and C++, and an entirely separate team works on that.
Yeah.
And the interface team are mostly separate, but if they've actually in the plumbing completely separated, yes, that would be somewhat slightly new.
I think that they've done that. You already see that in the fact that there's the normal native version, the big boy version, and of course the version that runs online, right? Which is where they've already done that.
Oh no, that's not necessarily the same thing.
But that's what I read basically. I don't know where, but
Microsoft Word has a layout engine, a very tightly written, self-contained layout engine written in C and C++. You're talking about file format compatibility and so forth, which is something different, and that the user interface on the web is completely new code.
Sorry,
we sidetracked there.
Where were we? We were talking about applications, weren't we?
The whole issue of compatibility. What is the benefit of Microsoft putting Office on ARM when it already works on x86, and how is this going to change like business enterprise buying habits?
I think that it's more of a defensive move, that they're trying to move to a new processor architecture that could better support system on a chip and lower power form factors and break out of the traditional desktop laptop form factor, because they're concerned that other platforms like iOS and Android are going to finally come up with an Office solution that will be more preferred, because just the device is more portable. And you're already seeing this with a lot of CEOs and a lot of other technophiles in offices, at least in the US, using iOS devices and preferring them, like such the iPad, instead of having a whole desktop. So I think this is a defensive maneuver by Microsoft to prevent people from just leaving the Windows ecosystem en masse, at least from the user perspective.
Well, we have to, there's no denying that Windows 7 on x86 tablets has completely and utterly failed.
That was obvious.
Kludge.
Definitely.
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating is this manic jump on tablets, and that amazingly Microsoft and Intel being complete bit players in this.
I'm still not convinced, by the way, about this whole tablet thing.
No, of course not.
It's only
been
a couple of months. I mean, I'm still not entirely sure, because in the end, when you really need to get work done, you got to need a keyboard. End of story. I mean, it's, you know,
Have you seen the new Samsung Slide, Dad?
Yeah, that was awesome.
I think that kind of puts my point to rest, though, from the last podcast, that it's not the tablet, it's not the form factor, it's not the operating system, it's not anything inherent to it other than the fact that it doesn't have a keyboard built into it. And you can get that.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. But in the end, I mean, that's more like a combination between a laptop and a tablet. So it basically makes both our points, right? I mean, it makes the point you're going to need a keyboard to do real work, except for, you know, some really weird people who like to punish themselves. But in the end, you're going to need a keyboard to get work done. But at the same time, a tablet also has its advantages of sitting on the couch and just, you know, using multitouch and all that stuff. And, you know, combining that is basically making both our points, I think.
I'm actually in disagreement. And I'll tell you why, because we do hear this all the time whenever tablets come up is, you can't do real work on a tablet or you know, any of these mobile platforms. And I think I'm in agreement in a certain sense, but what I disagree with the fact is that this concept that computing can't and won't change. Computing changed in, like, between the 80s and the 90s. You can go out and you can get a 1980s computer right now and you can use it, and it's every bit as fast and it's every bit as productive as it was the day it was built. But the world around us has changed, and that computer can no longer interoperate with everything around it, and it can't use the internet and all these other services around it. That yes. machine has become unproductive because of what's around it, not because of what it is.
Yeah, but it still has a keyboard.
Right, yes, but... My point is that computing completely changed from 80s to the 90s, such to the point that 1980s computers cannot be used productively anymore now, even though they're every bit as capable as they was. That will happen again. In 10 years' time, my laptop, the equipment I've got here right now, is perfectly adequate, and this hardware will still be around in 10 years, but I won't be able to be productive on it because the world around me will have changed.
Yeah, true, but that has more to do with things like the standards it does or does
not
support.
Exactly, and that's being driven by these tablets. The tablets are going to come along, and it's given us the opportunity to have a clean sweep with operating systems and with software.
Yeah, it's a new category. It's not a replacement. That's basically my point. What the laptops that we use today effectively replaced the laptops that the computers that we use today are used instead of the stuff that you used in the 80s. But tablets are more like an additional thing, not a replacement.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's first one then the other, because yeah. if you think about the office situation, there'll be someone saying, "Hey Bob, I've got this new computer, and I can keep all my stuff on it and do all this processing." And you know, Steve over there says, "Well, I've got my file system, I've got my inbox, I'm good with that. Why you don't need that sort of, you can't do real work on that." It's the same argument. It's the same argument you're making than that guy did years and years ago.
Yeah, things
it's
move on.
It's going to be first one, an ancillary piece of equipment, and then it will become a replacement.
Yeah,
it grows into replacement.
Yeah, the after tablets will come the replacement to the desktop. The tablet, the tablet and the new software and the new operating system and the multi-touch will lead to the replacement of the desktop computer.
Or maybe of the... Well, the desktop has already pretty much been replaced, at least in the home, with laptops, basically. But it's still...
Well, we're using this as an umbrella term again.
Yeah, okay, good. Just to, you know, make sure that that's the case. But I just... Maybe I'm just a little bit too much of a...
Obstinate.
Obviousness. I mean, that's pretty obvious for everyone who knows me.
But I think one of the reasons why me and you don't like all this hype around tablets is because it's offensive that... It's basically a bandwagon. You get offended by the fact that all these companies jump on this bandwagon and don't seem to be seeing things in a proper, you know, light. The only reason that CES is filled with like so many damn tablets is because of the iPad.
Yep.
If the iPad hadn't come out, would these companies be doing this? Why do they have such a short-sighted notion to only follow in the footsteps of someone like Apple, which is very annoying?
And I believe that even there's only like one company that really in any way comes close to the iPad. I didn't like the iPad at all, but and I don't think I will like any other tablet for the foreseeable future. But yeah, from what I read in reviews, that the only device that makes it, you know, like anywhere close to the iPad is the Galaxy Tab, and even there the opinions are very conflicted. So it's basically like the iPad and then nothing for 10 kilometers long, and then everything else. That's kind of
just wait. Just wait.
Yeah, of course, just wait. Of course, it'll get better. But right now, it's all the iPad, and everybody else is following, and they're following at a very they're following very far behind at this point.
Yes. I'd say. Well, getting back on topic, mentioning before the show that the reason that Microsoft won netbooks back was because of Intel. In fact, the only reason that Microsoft won netbooks back is because of Intel, because Microsoft plus Intel equals OEMs. And that that they got Windows XP and then Windows 7 to claw that back, and that Microsoft are nowhere to be seen in this instance with tablets, and that you've got everybody going with ARM chips and everybody going with Android, and shockingly, you suddenly Microsoft find themselves in the position of being a bit part player in the market, which is why they've got to react with Windows 8 and thing on Office on ARM. Where does this put Intel, I think?
In Dutch, you would say in the hoek waar de klappen vallen. Basically, they're in the position where they're going to get beaten up, basically. I mean, they have to really start working.
Well, if I remember how Intel is internally structured, there are actually two major divisions, the ones that design the chips and the ones that build it. My guess is the ones that are building it are going, yeah, so what, because... Mm. All they really need to do is, well, let's just license ARM from Freescale and be done with it. And then they just start making their own chips.
Too much pride.
Well, yes, that's mostly going to come from the designers, I think. I could be wrong about that. I don't know what the internal culture is at Intel, but that's kind of my guess. From a pragmatic business perspective, the manufacturing facilities of Intel still have validity, even if x86 were to become completely irrelevant tomorrow. They would just have to switch their build procedures to build a different architecture. Whereas the designers are going to have to figure out how to implement the ARM design, and they're going to become a little bit more obsolescent.
Intel's current direction, I believe, is basically to pile more stuff onto the silicon. The new released versions of i5s and i7s for this year have the Intel HD graphics built into the chip, and they're just announcing that the next set will also have DirectX 11 built directly into them as well. They're just trying to pile more into the silicon. It's obvious that everywhere is going towards a system on a chip, and that Intel are naturally going this direction as well. But
it's the best way to do it, really, in terms of making power requirements and integration and making sure that all the hardware actually works with each other. It's a lot lighter of a model just to have a chip that has the majority of the hardware on it. You can make a very small motherboard and reduce the power requirements because you don't have to have as complicated circuitry to handle all the different I/O. I mean, I can imagine how that was because I remember building one of those things from chips back in high school.
But Intel are so far behind in the power. I mean, all they've got is power. They've got the faster, the more powerful chips, yes, but their actual power-to-watt ratio is inescapable given the complexities and the sheer amount of history for x86 compatibility on software.
Yeah, yeah. The fundamental architecture of x86 was not built with power consumption in mind, unlike ARM, which has had a strong emphasis on that. I think... It would be interesting if Intel were to set their pride aside and actually try to make the fastest ARM chip in the world. That would be really quite impressive, actually. That would make sure that they remain an important market player.
Speaking of ARM and power, one thing I did want to mention in passing was the announcement from Freescale. Freescale announces new low-power multi-core processors. Freescale have an i.MX 6 series platform, which are based around Cortex A9 cores, which are the latest ARM multi-core technology, and they're making chips in single, dual, and quad-core ARM processors. Now, what's interesting about this was that buried down in the bottom of the announcement was that the chip also includes support for the VP8 codec. So it means that hardware support for WebM is coming and will be in the sort of next generation of tablets and, well, laptops, if we ever see an ARM laptop for once.
Well, now that Windows there, that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
With but again, it would all depend on how they're going to handle the application situation. That, you know, on tablets they can get away with, of course, creating a new ecosystem with new applications, yeah. And that's perfectly fine. But what I got from the announcement by both Microsoft as well as Nvidia is that they're not just working towards tablets or even phones. They're also working on, I mean, Nvidia even mentioned like high performance computing and laptops, desktops, and, you know, all that stuff, and servers even. So, I mean, there has to be some – on servers, not much of a problem, I think, because on servers you either run open source software, which is probably already available on ARM, or you're a Microsoft-only shop and you have a whole boatload of Microsoft software, which Microsoft can port by itself to ARM. But on desktops and laptops, it's a bit of a different situation. I mean, there you're going to have some sort of way of getting old stuff – old between quotation marks, old stuff to run on your new ARM laptop or ARM Windows ARM laptop or Windows ARM desktop. There has to be some way to run your old stuff, yep. Because you know you can't expect that massive ecosystem to switch to ARM in a couple of weeks or even in a year.
This is not like
it's still not even that simple in the server space either, because if you go to enterprise software, not everyone is just a Microsoft shop.
No, true. Yeah.
But you have a lot of Java.
Well, it's not just that either. There's a lot of other pieces of software, database managers, middleware that's going to be running on compiled code for x86, and all of that's going to have to be rewritten.
Yeah.
So this is actually a concern within the enterprise space as well. You can't discount that.
No, I know, but I mean the problem is smaller than it is on the desktop side of things, I would say.
This is not like
more your area than mine. I mean,
tell that to an enterprise architect.
Of course, that's true.
I'll have headaches for 5 years.
One suggestion of solution is like what Apple did with Rosetta, and I wanted to say that this is not like Apple's transition from PowerPC to Intel, because they had the benefit that they were changing from an older chip to a newer, more powerful chip that had the overhead to emulate the old chip. Whereas this isn't going to be the case. They're not switching. Switching to ARM is going to be something that's going to be less powerful than the Intel chip that it's replacing, and there wouldn't be enough in there to emulate it unless the chip has something on die to do it. That's what we're in the dark at the moment. Is it going to be an incompatibility? Is it going to be x86 board onto the chip, or is it going to be done through software, or is Microsoft really doing a clean slate here? In which case, I have to ask the question: what is the big sell to companies? Why are they going to say you can buy this Intel or you can buy this ARM, which isn't as compatible and it can't run this software, and you need to recompile this? What is the benefit? What's the magical sale?
ROI. It's return on investment, because it's not the amount of money that you're going to spend on the particular hardware. It's going to be how much the upkeep is over time. And if the new software development is going to be focusing on an ARM architecture and the power requirements are going to be a lot less, which is a major concern for data centers, especially as energy prices increase, this is actually going to be a positive for the ARM architecture versus an x86 architecture.
On the consumer end, I can see it, because
even in the enterprise end,
I would say.
Especially in the enterprise section, because power is a huge, huge concern. That's why so many companies are considering moving to cloud computing, because they can more or less outsource their idle time. They don't need to spend money powering the system for idle time, because they don't need to pay the service provider for that, because they're time sharing with everyone else.
And Microsoft,
it's just another evolution of that concept that's already in cloud computing.
There's another thing that Microsoft could do. There's been a lot of talk, it's pretty much confirmed, that Windows 8 will have a software store or an app store or whatever you want to call it.
About time.
Yeah, and it's what did you say? Sorry,
About time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And
I mean, I'd be happy with a package manager for the love of.
Exactly, but that's exactly what's going to happen. That's exactly what you know the people who are really following Microsoft and who have contacts in the company and everything are saying is that Microsoft's actually working on we just call it the whole Jupyter thing with a new app development model, whatever it's called. I don't know all the terms, but. A part of it is that it's more geared towards like .NET and Silverlight and stuff like that. But it will also have a new package format. I mean, if Microsoft has that software store up and running on every Windows 8 machine and they require application entries to be in that new format, then developers won't have that much. They'll have a lot of inclination to follow it because that software store will be available on every Windows 8 machine in the world. And within 6 months, there will be more Windows 8 machines than there will be other machines. So, well,
the implication of that entire process is that what's going to happen with the version of the operating system Microsoft produces after Windows 8? I thought Ballmer actually had pointed out that Windows 8 was the end of the Windows line in terms of the NT series kernel, and that they were going to move to a newer kernel architecture, which means that, by implication, Windows 8 should be a transitional operating system that's going to have the foundation of the next kind of stuff in it. That
it has
will,
to be. No
it
choice.
Would have to be in order to make consumers and enterprises familiar with it so that they can move to
how
it.
How would they sell
and
Windows
whatever
7 plus
the next
1?
Version is, if it's even called Windows. Mm. Probably will be.
Mm. I just received spam on Skype. What the hell is this?
They're branching out into new markets.
No, find new friends and real sex partners online right now. Search millions of member profiles and find your perfect match. Create your profile absolutely free and then a URL.
Call them. We'll put them on the podcast.
What the hell is going... The internet is...
My name's Carly.
Both of you have no idea how much that happens on Skype, because both of you have your gender markers on your profiles labeled as male. If you have it labeled as female, you'll get propositions and random conversations from people in Iran all the frickin' time, and you have to lock down your account to make sure you don't get these random people trying to you know, get to know Americans because of the misconceptions about us. Yes. I'll leave it at that. All of the listeners, imagine what that is.
Oh, crap. That is really odd. Okay, what were we talking about? We were talking about Windows, I think.
Yeah, we were talking about what comes after Windows 8 and what the implication of moving to ARM and Jupyter would actually imply, as well as a possible app store.
Yeah. And they could use the App Store as a way to get developers to move to the new development environment thing, and then use that as a way to coerce developers into modernizing their software, basically, until they finally get that break going where they're going to leave all the old stuff behind and move to the new.
I think a lot of this is actually to do with hardware. Microsoft want new hardware, and they're seeing that this is going in any number of possible directions. You've got tablets, you've got set-top boxes, you've got like media extenders. It's going everywhere. And
also,
they don't have... Sorry, Karen.
Yeah, something I wanted to mention is that this is not... I see a lot of people who seem to think that this switch to ARM is some sort of panic move that they developed 2 weeks ago. That's not the case. They've been starting to clean up the entire NT code base, starting with Longhorn back in, I believe they started in 2002 or 2003. That's when they started to untangle what, I mean, I believe Mark Russinovich called Windows NT and all the subsystems a big ball of spaghetti. And they started to, untangling that mess about seven or eight years ago. So this is not, this is all just part of it, you know, to get NT back to a nice modularized, componentized system that would be easier to port to new architecture, that would be more ready for possible hardware changes. So this is not something that just been done two weeks ago. It's not something they didn't port Windows to ARM over the past 6 months. I wouldn't be surprised if they had it running for years already.
Kernel, yes, but the user space has always been the thorn in their side.
Yeah, but that's all part of the... They started at the bottom to clean everything up, and like untangling the kernel, having no outward calls at a certain point, and you know, and they started moving up the stack. That's basically how all those Windows kernel specialists who did a couple of presentations as well, that's how they described it. Like, we started at the bottom, and then we started moving upwards and untangling all the mess. So it's they probably had the kernel running on ARM a long time ago, and then started adding all the layers as soon as they were untangled from the mess, basically. And I think it's pretty much, well, it's not probably not done because it's probably in alpha phase and maybe beta, I don't know. And then they are not just ready for a switch to ARM, but they could be ready for future changes. But the last problem, of course, are all the applications, which we've been talking about for a while now. That's, of course, the last step, and that's the step that Microsoft can't really control. They can only try to push developers into third-party developers into a certain direction. They can't command them to do something. So now they have to find ways to push developers to write code, or to change their code, or to write stuff that isn't tied to x86. So. But the operating system is ready for it. I'm sure of it.
They don't really need to push them that hard, is the other thing. They've been trying to move people to .NET for years and years and years, and they've largely succeeded at that in terms of any new code that's not going to be some hardcore server code in C or C++. Most of the user applications will probably be written in .NET, and .NET is a lot more portable as an operating, as a environment for programmers than Win32. You have to remember that there's a difference between Win32 and .NET programs. The Windows application landscape is actually more varied than what we're presenting here.
I have to interrupt because there's a really weird noise in my headphones. As if somebody's blowing continuously into his microphone.
Yeah, the call quality has suddenly just gone to crap.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stop, hang up, and recall.
Yeah, that's okay.
Some reason the call quality just suddenly went to complete crap. I think the bandwidth was notched down; it wouldn't come back up again.
Yeah,
probably my fault.
Okay, we're back.
We're back. Right. We could use that as an opportunity to move on. Perhaps we've done about 40 minutes. I think.
Yep.
Already.
Time flies. Okay, so what
were we... Time flies when you're arguing on the OS News podcast.
Yeah, it actually does, by the way, for those that are just listening. The time really does fly. It's really weird. It's crazy. But what are we going to talk about now? I'm open to anything.
Anything big enough. I was suggesting the PS3 complete fail, if you wanted to discuss that.
I don't know what I would have to add.
I'm just happy to describe the actual story as it's happened. Annual Chaos, what's it called? Chaos Communication Central. CCC convention has been runs each year. It's called 27C3. It's the 27th one, and each year they have a panel on console hacking, and a group called Fail Overflow released their PS3 code that year. And basically, they've broken open the PS3. They've managed to hack it so that they've got access to the master signing keys, AES keys, so that they can sign software and it looked the PS3 as if it's from Sony themselves. And therefore, you can store any firmware you want over any firmware you want. There's no having to try and downgrade before you can then do anything custom. It is a complete and absolute, you know, the system has been broken wide open.
I
was going to say, and the reason that they've managed to do this is because Sony made an absolutely incredible boneheaded mistake of not making the keys random enough. You're supposed to, every time you sign something, introduce a completely random factor into the signing process, and they didn't. They used the same one over and over again, and because of this, using some simple algebra, they solved for X. And
algebra is never simple.
Well, I see simple in inverted commas. This is AES.
Okay, good.
We're talking about, which is just, you know, RSA encryption, which is mind-boggling at the best. But basically, because Microsoft, Apple, so we'll get there eventually. Sony.
No, you're talking about close companies. First, Microsoft,
Sony. Which enemy do I want? I'm trying to pick them. Yeah.
They're lighting up.
Sony did how the brain works.
Such an incredible bonehead mistake that they didn't even have to reverse engineer this. They didn't have to try and brute force the keys or anything like that. They just literally worked it out. And once they'd got that, they were able to break down various other... The PS3 security all hinged on that one factor. Like, once you've broken one part of the system, then you can provide input to the next stage, which is, looks exactly the same as it's from Sony, and therefore the security all the way down the line falls apart. They've managed to replace Game OS, which is the operating system that's used for driving games and has more access to the system, and they've replaced that with their own operating system, what they've called Asbestos, and that then allows the installation of things like Linux, etc., on the computer, and will eventually allow full access to the hardware.
This is actually one in a long line of programming fails from Sony's hardware. I remember when I was mucking around with doing homebrew on the PSP, there were so many little weird code mistakes that they kept finding here and there and everywhere. And I keep wondering if half of the time, despite Sony's huff and guff about making sure that their hardware is very, very much controlled, that the programmers are actually going, I'm just not going to pay attention to that. It's like, maybe they'll find this eventually.
Well, they did. Because it's the funny thing is, though, that the idea is now that it can't be fixed, right? That this is the done deal. They can't fix this without issuing new hardware. And Sony appears to be a little bit oblivious because it's probably just a random PR statement. So I don't put too much value in it, but they said, we'll just issue a network update and we'll get it fixed. No problem. Basically, no problem. All is well on the Western Front. You know, it's just, I love the comment, by the way, that someone left where he basically paraphrased the Iraqi
information minister.
Like, they are not in Baghdad, like, you know, that sort of thing. That was, that's,
well,
that's,
it depends on where this master key is actually encoded. If they actually have the ability to flash the firmware without and replace that key with something new.
It's burned into the hardware. It's fundamental to everything. The thing is that now that the hackers have got hold of this key, anything they write can be signed such as that it's indistinguishable from anything that Sony writes. So if Sony publish any firmware that tries to prevent anything, the hackers can now write software that is indistinguishable to the console than it is from Sony. So they can only put up barriers which any hacker could get over within 1 or 2 hours. They cannot put up any barrier which is insurpassable now.
And if they were to replace the master key, which is probably possible with a network update, then all the older games, all the stuff that's been developed for the PlayStation 2 would simply stop working because the master key has changed. So it's... they can't fix this other than releasing a new console, which they're not planning on doing for at least 4 years.
Not necessarily a new console. So. One possibility is they could release new hardware which contains a checksum list in it of all the games that have been released prior, which it's allowed to run. You could technically do that, but again, it's the issue that... if it's just a checksum list, then hackers could find a way to get in there and put their own checksums in or break down that barrier or anything like that. Sony are in a real sort of mess here now.
Yep.
What does Sony get out of this anyway?
Now, what they get out of it is...
I just don't understand why Sony seems to be so insistent on defeating all of these other measures. What do they get out of it? No one's writing viruses for PS3s.
No, it's about piracy. It's all about piracy. They need to be able to tell the game publishers, our system is safe from piracy. And up until a couple of weeks ago, they could say that. They could say... the PlayStation 3 is completely free of piracy, which it was, because you couldn't run...
Since 2006, it hasn't been properly cracked, but 12 months after they removed the other OS function in the PS3 Slim, then it was cracked. So, they have brought this upon themselves.
Yep, definitely. Now, they didn't just remove the other OS feature from new hardware, as in they left it out. No. They also removed it from existing consoles.
Which is completely illegal in Europe.
Yeah, that was the issue. If they had just released the Slim and said, look, it doesn't have that feature, okay. I mean, it sucks, but that's, you know, fine. It's new hardware. That's fine. That's acceptable. But they really started to piss off all these guys, these hackers, as soon as they started mucking with established functionality. You don't do that. That's one of the most stupid things you can do, is to take – is to give a hacker a system that's – I market it as, look, you can run it's exotic hardware and you can run Linux on it. I mean, it's – for a lot of people, it might be a small group, but it's a group of really smart people. So you don't want to mess with those guys. Yeah.
And they're not interested in piracy.
No, they're clearly not interested in piracy. I mean, other people will be. Trust me. Someone else, other than the hackers you're currently reading about who are doing the real trench work, they're not interested in hacking. But there will be someone else who will take what they've done, their work, and they will...
Yeah. Pirates are not that smart. No. The hackers are doing this have explicitly said that they have no interest in piracy. They only did this because Sony removed other OS from them. The PS3 was not hacked for such a long time because you could already run Linux on it, and that was all they were interested in doing, is being able to run their own code on the hardware that they own. And Sony removed that from them.
Yeah, so now they've... and now those hackers, of course, were pissed off, so they basically announced right from the start, we're going to give you guys other OS back. That's what they said. We're going to give it back to you. But by giving that back, they automatically also open the gates for someone else, less smart, who can't do the actual hacking, to do a little bit of work and enable piracy.
They haven't bothered to go after the game signing code. So there's a lot of keys in the PS3. There is a per console key which hasn't yet been broken. You've got the master key, which basically handles all the bootloading stuff, so that you can change the firmware. But also you have keys that are used for the signing of games, and they're there, and they haven't bothered to crack them, but basically in their code they describe the whole process of how about they got the master key, and that someone could eventually break the game signing key and open the door to piracy.
So it's basically Sony's own fault. If they had just left other OS in on existing consoles, nobody would have it wouldn't have happened, at least not this quick.
Because I mean, there was this what's it called? PS jailbreak thing, a USB which uses a fault in the USB stack on the PS3 to allow piracy. But again, that was solved with a firmware update, and wasn't a complete complete break of the system.
Yeah, exactly.
What else to say? Sony suck.
Well, for this one, yeah, they definitely do. It's kind of fun, though. I'm looking at a PlayStation 3 now. I borrowed it from someone who's on a working vacation in the Alps, so he's gone for like 4 to 5 months, and I'm borrowing his PlayStation 3. And right around the time that I picked that thing up and put it down here in my own home, I heard about the hack, so that was kind of fun. I'm not going to do it, of course. It's not my machine, obviously, but it still is kind of funny. I don't really have a whole lot to add there at this point.
We'll have to wait for more to come out. Uh-huh. That's about it, really.
I think I don't know what else we could say, what we could talk about. I think we've pretty much covered the most interesting things. Oh, yeah, I do have to say, the Mac App Store is an ugly piece of crap. Okay, next. Yeah, I'm going to remove it. I was about to do some cleanup on my MacBook Air, and I also wanted to remove iTunes because I don't use it and I hate it with a passion. So I started looking at, I knew that it wasn't as easy as just, dragging iTunes to the trash, because that's a myth, of course, that you can uninstall an application by moving it to the trash, because it leaves a whole boatload of crap behind. And I figured iTunes would leave a lot behind. And basically, I found a document on this Apple support site that details how to completely remove iTunes from Mac OS X. And does anybody want to take a guess at how many steps it requires to completely remove a music player from
Mac OS X? 26 steps to file a bug with Microsoft. So is any worse than that?
Yeah, it's 29 steps.
Oh my god! Oh jeez.
Okay, so it's you need to drag iTunes to the trash. They need to go. You need to open Activity Monitor. You need to close the iTunes Helper. The process several processes. Then you need to go to Accounts to make sure it doesn't start again. Then you need to go to System Library Extensions. Then you need to go to Library Receipts. Then you need to go – oh, it's a total mess. So I figured – I've never bought AppZapper, but you can do five uninstalls I've said before, you need to buy it. So I figured, well, let's just use that. But that only deletes a very small portion of all the files that Apple is describing in its in that support document. And just for fun, I went to the Microsoft website to find out. I already knew it, but I just wanted to see how easy it is to remove Windows Media Player from Windows 7. And it's extremely easy, because all you need to go is to add remove Windows features and remove a check mark and press OK. It's like 30 seconds of work. So it's this is one of those things that
I'm not a Mac user, but I was astonished how ugly the App Store was. I mean, yeesh.
Yeah, it's really ugly, I know. But
what
thing
did
is,
you do to the title bar?
Yeah, it's so fat. It's like it's an American title bar now. No offense. It's just so incredibly fat. It's really weird. But you know, this is kind of a common issue with Mac OS X. Mac OS X works really well if you follow the paths that the use case is set out by Cupertino. But as soon as you want to do something that is slightly off the beaten track, then you're in trouble, and you're going to have to do really crazy things. Whereas the advantage of having something like Windows, where you have so many users that even if you're a fringe case, even if you have a fringe use case, there will inevitably be thousands of others who have that same fringe use case. So, and on Linux, of course, I mean, everything is possible. So that doesn't really come into play. But this is one of the reasons why Mac OS X often feels so restrictive, because I just want to remove a music player. That's all. I just want to have it gone. This machine only has the small SSD, which is 64 gigabytes. So I just want to have as much stuff removed as possible, just in case I ever run into the 64 limit. So I want to remove iTunes, because it's a music player that takes up like 200 megabytes. I mean, it's 200 megabytes, and I don't use iTunes. I hate it. I don't listen to music on this thing. Just get it out of my system. Get it out of the system. But it takes 29 steps. And I've been looking at that tab for 2 days now. And I'm just, it's so boring. I don't want to do it. But I have to. It just boggles the mind how you can mess something up so badly. But that's just, you know.
No, it's a commercial remit. Apple are varnishing themselves into a corner with iTunes, and in that everything has to go through damn iTunes. And that when really, they should be innovating a lot more outside of this.
It surprises me, though, that the Mac App Store isn't part of iTunes. That would be awesome. That probably explains why it's so ugly. But no, that would have been that's probably would have made more sense.
It is the same technology. The Mac App Store is basically the same thing as how you view the iTunes Store inside iTunes. It's a WebKit view connecting to an Apple server.
Yeah, I just opened the App Store. It's so ugly. You can do that too right now. It's just so ugly.
This is what's going to become normal. Digital distribution is basically it. And
yeah, that's fine. That's
every
fine,
operating but, system is going to have one of these things.
Yeah, but not like, don't make it look like this, please. I just don't understand. I mean, a couple of comments on OS News on the article that I wrote explained that to do this, to make it look like this with the off-center title, the weird combination of what they're doing in the UI on the top, you have to actually work. You explicitly can't do this. You can't do this by accident. You can't by accident come up with icons that don't look like anything else. You can't make this search field unique. It's always the same everywhere in the operating system. Every text input field is exactly the same. You can't just do this. Takes actual work. You have to sit down and code to make it look like this. This is not an accident. This is not done because this is not a rush job, right?
This is very telling. If you click on the updates button and it just tells me all apps are up to date, look at the bottom of the page. It says copyright 2011 iTunes SAL, all rights reserved. This is the iTunes Store. It's going to just a different web page on the iTunes Store.
Here it says Apple Inc.
Is it really? Mine says iTunes SAL.
Huh?
I don't know why. Okay.
I know why. I switched country setting to the United States because otherwise the App Store would inexplicably be Dutch, and all my software is in English. Is in English because I hate Dutch on computers. So I explicitly switched it to America because at least I get the English App Store. So that's probably why I get, you know, Apple Inc. and you get iTunes SRL.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. Yeah.
It's still the same infrastructure on the back basically. So fun. Anyway,
no, it's crazy. Let's see what happens if I switch back to Dutch real quick. Where is it? The Netherlands.
It'll have to be, because iTunes Sal is the European arm for legal reasons, the registration in in Europe.
Updates. There we go. Yeah, I think, iTunes. Oh, it's Italian, isn't it? S-A-R-L. I believe that's Italian, if I'm not mistaken. That's an Italian legal designation. I'm not sure, though.
I'm sure it's for tax reasons, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, of course it is for tax reasons. That's obvious. Okay, well, that was all I wanted to say.
Rant over?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, and so I think we can wrap it up there.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tom and Tess, for your time. Everybody, if you'd like to leave any comments, please, you can do so on the website osnews.com when this podcast is published. You can email us at crew@osnews.com, also with any of your thoughts. And that's about all that's there is to say. Thank you very much. Hopefully we'll see you next time.
Yep. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.